All right, welcome to another episode of ICU Doc Talk. It comes that time again where I realize that I have a podcast and that I should probably do a recorded episode and that there actually are people that listen to it. So it's been a bit. You know, I usually get guilted into it from people on TikTok that are like, when's the next episode? So you got me, you twisted my arm, and so here I am. And don't get me wrong, I do enjoy doing the podcast. I'm sorry, I know it's really scattered, but as you can imagine, life gets very busy. And sometimes I'm just not super motivated. But you motivate me. When I see the comments on TikTok, be like, hey, get on here, get on the podcast. It does, it motivates me to come and do this. So here I am. I think I'm going to talk about today kind of my, what, I know I always talk about my job. That's like a big part of this podcast. I'm going to go through the different aspects of my job and maybe like kind of daily what I go through. And then I kind of want to kind of sum it up with like my philosophies about career and life balance. My personal philosophies. Spoiler alert, I care about my family and not my job. Okay. obviously I care about my job, but I think there's been a fundamental shift for me in medicine. There should be a shift in medicine. I think old school medicine is like, and this applies to academic medicine, which I am in, right? I'm in academia. I work at a major academic, an American academic institution. And so I work in academic medicine. I feel like the old school thought is, well, you got it. Your career is very important. Academic advancement, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, you know, you might sacrifice family time. You got to go on. You got to advance your position. You got to do these things. To me, nonsense. I completely reject that philosophy. Your career should not be the number one thing in your life. It just shouldn't. It doesn't matter what you do. Life is way too freaking short to care about your career that much and to place all, you know, the seat of your ego in your career. So my family is number one, right? I have a daughter and my wife, and then my extended family from there is number one. I don't care about anything else. Relative, right? I'm obviously exaggerating a little bit. I do care about my job, my career, and all that stuff, but family is number one. So, and I'm going to get into that a little bit, what I mean by that and how I try to actively make family my number one thing in my life. So I'll back it up a little bit. Let's just talk about my day. So what do? I do anesthesia. I'm an anesthesiologist and I'm a critical care, intensivist. So I double boarded in both. I do both things. So how does that work? This always surprises people. They're always like, I thought you were an anesthesiologist. I thought you were an intensivist. How do you do these both? And it's very unusual to people. It's actually not that unusual. In Europe, this is how it's done. If you are an intensivist in many countries in Europe, you are an anesthesiologist. It's they get standard training. They do both. So I do both. And a lot of people wonder how that works. So I'm going to talk about that and kind of how it's split up. And it is split up very finitely it's totally compartmentalized. Okay. So let's start. So when I'm doing anesthesia, I'm only doing anesthesia, right? And it's a week. It's usually weeks at a time. My schedule is built and weeks at a time. So when I'm on anesthesia, here's what my day is like, right? I get up in the morning. I get up at like, I don't know, usually like 5:15, get up in the morning and I, make my yerba mate, which is a highly caffeinated South American tea that invigorates me. And then I go to work. Okay. I go to my office and then I look at my patient's cases for that day. I look at what kind of cases I'm covering as the anesthesia provider. And I look them up. I look them up the day of. I usually don't look them up the night before or the day or 2 days before or anything like that, because an OR schedule is extremely volatile and it often changes even overnight. So what I've learned through my career is that if I look up patients the night before or, you know, 2 days before, it's frequently a waste of time because that patient fell off the list. They're not going to have that surgery, et cetera, et cetera. So I've wasted mental energy preparing for a case that never happens. So I prepare the morning of. So I drink my mate Oh, and I record a TikTok video. So that is now part of my life. I drive to work. I usually listen to an audiobook. I mean, I always listen to an audiobook, and it's always nonfiction. It's usually about economics or politics or a lot of stuff, whatever. You know, I talk about books all the time on here. So I listen to an audiobook. I usually record a stupid TikTok video real quick. It takes me like 2 seconds. I upload that. I don't know if you want these details. Anyway, and then I look up patient cases for that day. Usually take about 30 minutes. The day starts off covering two operating rooms. The practice that I have where I'm in my institution is I cover multiple rooms at a time with a nurse anesthetist or resident in each room. I don't do MD only, usually what it's called. Some practices have one anesthesiologist in one room. In my opinion, that is not necessary anymore. That is too expensive of a practice. We don't need to do that. Nurse anesthetists are very capable and they're very safe anesthesiologists. They are providers. They're highly trained people. I happen to work with phenomenal nurse anesthetists. They're incredible. It's an incredible group of people. In my opinion, having MD only anesthesiologists, one per room, is not necessary, and it's too expensive, and that cost goes to the patient, it goes to the insurance company. I don't think it's necessary. Maybe you're listening to this and you're like, you're like mad because you're an anesthesiologist, but it's just not necessary. It's not. Safe practices definitely can happen with nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologists covering. For sure, I know it. Anyway, so I start with two operating rooms. I look at the cases. I cover a variety of cases. I cover like ENT surgeries a lot, which I love covering. I cover urology. I cover big GI like cancer cases, like abdominal cancer, resections, like Whipples. I cover HIPEX, which stands for hyperthermic. What does it stand for? I forget what it stands for. HIPEX, HIPEC, hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy for people that have cancer in their belly, carcinomatosis is what it's called, and it's a procedure that they take out a bunch of cancer out of your stomach and then infuse chemotherapy in your stomach, and they shake it around for 90 minutes to try to help clear the abdominal space, peritoneum of cancer tissue. So those are, you know, big cases. What else do I cover? Trauma cases. Plastic surgery, a little ortho in my main division. Now I float to many divisions. I work in an enormous academic center and there's a lot of divisions I float at. So I cover all types of anesthesia, right? Vascular surgery and OB. I don't do OB. Gynecology, which is different, right? Like that's, you know, a hysterectomy, or cover stuff like that. Lots of different cases, urology, ophthalmology, stuff like that. The two things I don't do are cardiac surgery, because I'm not trained in cardiac anesthesiology. So I don't do anesthesia for cardiac. I do ICU for cardiac surgery, just to be clear. That's my main intensive care practice. So when I'm wearing my intensivist hat, I'm doing mostly cardiac ICU. But I don't do anesthesia. And then I don't do OB. Not because I don't like it, but that's just not, I just didn't fall in that way in practice. So I do not do OB anesthesia. So I don't do, you know, epidurals for laboring women and C-sections. I don't do that. I start my day out with two cases, whatever they are. Sometimes they're big cases, sometimes they're boring cases. And that's one of the reasons I like anesthesiology. You can have a very easy, boring day. You can have a very intense day. It just depends on the day, whatever comes to that door. It's one of the great appeals of anesthesia. It's one of the reasons I went into it. So I look at my patients. I eat a little breakfast. I usually eat oatmeal because it's very filling and low in calorie. Again, I don't know if you care about these details, but I'm giving to you nevertheless. And then I go see my patients in the preoperative waiting area. I go say hello to them. I do a pre-op examination. I've talked about that. I don't need to bore you with all those details. I say hello, what the plan is, et cetera. And then I go communicate with the provider in the room, whether that's a nurse anesthetist or a resident. I talk with them about, hey, I saw the patient. Here's the plan. Let's do this. Is that, what's your input? Do you want to do this? Do that? I'm very flexible. If you talk to a nurse anesthetist that works with me or a resident, I'm very flexible. I'm not someone who's like, oh, we have to do this, we have to do this. There's many ways to skin a cat in medicine. I'm a very flexible provider, just as long as we're providing safe care. I don't care how we do it. I don't care how you anesthetize this patient. There's many ways to anesthetize people. Let's just do it in a safe way. And we're off and running. Again, I cannot stress how amazing the people I work with. I love the people I work with. I love the nurse anesthetist group that I work with. They are awesome, awesome people. Seriously. So then we start our cases, right? Usually induce, you know, whatever breathing tube, whatever the case is, give the drugs, secure the airways, and then the cases are running. And then I usually will take over cases. So I send colleagues home, my anesthesiologist colleagues that were here late the night before. We have this call system, this peel-off call system. They were late the night before. Maybe they were late as 8 or 9. Maybe they worked a 16-hour day sometimes. Sometimes it's longer than that. Sometimes it's less than that. And then I take their rooms and send them home once they start their rooms. And I cover up to 4 rooms at a time. Usually only 3, but then later in the day, you can go to up to 4. That, again, this is my practice. Many practices are different. If I have residents in the room, I cannot take more than 2 cases. If I have even just 1 resident, you cannot take more than 1 case where I practice. But I can take up to 4, cover 4 cases. Is this safe? Yes, this is a safe practice. Anyway, so I have varying days in the OR, and I love being in the OR. I love being an anesthesiologist. It's one of the best jobs on the planet, in my opinion. It's incredible. I think the job of being a nurse anesthetist is also an amazing job. I work with amazing people. Okay, so that's, you know, my OR week. And I can have chill days, and that's great. And then I remember when I was a medical student, and I was thinking of going to surgery, and I saw what the surgeons were doing all day, and then I saw what the, you know, anesthesia staff was doing all day, and I was like, I think I'd rather be part of the anesthesia team because that looks like a better job. So there's days that are chill. You know, you're doing sinus surgeries all day, and those are very uneventful, and they're awesome. And then there's days that are very exciting, right? You're taking out a pheochromocytoma of a you know, 21-year-old kid whose blood pressure is all over the place, and you have to deal with that, or bleeding out, or, you know, stuff like that. So it can be very exciting. It's a very versatile job. And I very much enjoy it. I think, and I'm very lucky to have that as part of my career. So that's what I do when I'm in the OR. And then when I switch to ICU, it's not mixed. It's not like one day I'm in the OR and the next day I'm in the ICU. It's a week on. It's weeks at a time. So I'll finish my OR week or whatever, and then I do ICU. And when I do ICU, when I do days, either I do days or I do nights. And I do a week straight when I'm on days, and it's 7 days straight. It's Monday through Sunday. And there's many different models across institutions that do this. At my institution, we do shift work, so I do 12-hour shifts, and there's a nighttime nocturnist, an intensivist at night, who's my counterpart, who I also do. We switch out between these roles. So when I'm on a week, 7 days straight, it's, in 12 hours, it can go longer than that because things happen and you can't always leave right away. So, you know, it's 80, 90 hour work week. So, and then I have a week off, 7 days off after I do that. So that's, you know, paying you back, right? So if you're considering going into intensive care, if you're like a medical student or a resident, or you're whatever, you're a ICU, you're a nurse and you want to go to ICU, whatever. It's not time off. People are like, oh, that's a sweet deal. You just work 7 days and then get 7 days off. It is not a luxury, those 7 days off. I've probably said this before. It is a necessity. You cannot have you cannot work in intensive care sustainably unless you have time given back to you that you have missed. It's time given back to me that I've missed, right? Because that's a lot of work to do in 7 days. And, I see my wife and daughter maybe 2 hours a day when I'm on those 7 days, right? When I get home. And that's, you know, that's hard. And then, but then I get that those seven days off and I see my daughter 24/7 and my wife 24/7. And this is really the meat of what I'll talk a little bit more about my intensivist job, but this is the meat of what I wanted to get into is that my priority, it's obvious to say this, right? My priority is being with my family when I'm not working. So when I'm on those 7 days, it's a very tiring, exhausting week, right? It's tiring and exhausting in every way imaginable. It's physically exhausting, but then it's psychologically exhausting because your cognitive load is very high. I'm making a ton of decisions every single day, every moment. And then it's emotionally exhausting. It's morally exhausting as well. Because there's a lot of moral decisions that must be made. And then I mostly work in a cardiac ICU. So these are very oftentimes very, very sick patients. There's a lot of healthy patients that come through, right? Like that breeze through, right? The majority of patients, when you hear me talking, I'm usually talking about the disasters. because it's something to talk about. The majority of patients successfully have cardiac surgery and then leave like the next day out of the ICU. Like they're fine. That's the that is the course of the majority of patients that undergo a cardiotomy and have cardiac surgery. You know, they're great. They come up, they're on cardiopulmonary bypass for their surgery, whatever. They come up, that causes all sorts of physiological derangements to their body. And then they get over that, and we wean off their whatever support they need. And then they're extubated, and the next day they're great. The thumbs up, their pain is controlled, we send them out, right? The next day. Majority of patients. But there's a lot of disasters that cardiac surgery is very dangerous to the human body. There's a lot of disasters that happen. A lot of these patients are very sick when they come for cardiac surgery, right? Their hearts are in bad conditions. They have terrible coronary artery disease. They have bad cardiomyopathy for whatever reason. And then the patient populations I deal with are heart transplant, lung transplant patients, and then patients that are on ECMO for many of those reasons. I deal with patients that have ARDS and they're on VV ECMO. So lots of sick patients. And then there's so many moral implications. There's so many ethical implications about keeping patients on ECMO. For those of you that don't know, that's a lung heart bypass machine that keeps people alive. Even someone's heart that is not moving, that should be dead, we're keeping them alive by having them on a heart pump that's perfusing their organs in place of their heart. Right. So, and sometimes people are on this for too long. They don't have any hope of getting it through, but their patients' families, the families are still have that hope, and then navigating that and doing it respectfully and not causing them trauma for saying goodbye to their loved one too soon, and having a good balance of autonomy, which they should have autonomy. They shouldn't have absolute autonomy. In the United States, we give patients and their families more autonomy than they do in other places of the world. Other places of the world, the medical staff just says we're done and then stops care, which I don't think is the right way of doing things personally. But patients' families should have some sort of autonomy, but not absolute autonomy. Healthcare staff should have a time to be like, no, we're not providing care anymore. It's time to say goodbye, which I have to do every now and then, but I, you know, try to do it tactfully. And it's important not to cause trauma to people and their families, because they're going to remember these moments for the rest of their lives, right? The rest of their lives are going to remember these last moments with their loved one. And just the wrong word, the wrong way you say things can probably cause PTSD. So I think that is well within the realm of critical care, is to also help patients' families to not have trauma from saying goodbye to their loved ones. Anyway, these are very exhausting. I always go on rebel. These are very exhausting weeks. The more you do it, the easier it gets. Okay. So again, if you're a medical student resident considering going to intensive care and you had a month in the ICU and you hated it, well, that was a month straight in the ICU. Once you're an actual attending, you don't do a month straight in the ICU. Right? It's mixed with other stuff, and it gets easier, and you get better at it, and you get better at navigating these things, and it starts to become second nature. Having end of life talks. I remember when I was, you know, a young attending or a resident having an elect, you know, you'd like psych yourself up and be like, okay, I'm going to say this and this. I don't do that anymore. You don't need to do that. Just act normal. You don't need to prepare lines. Maybe you do. I don't know. It depends on what your skill set is in talking with people. But I don't, you just talk to people like it is. I've talked about this before, right? You just tell people like it is. You be real with them. You be transparent with them. People are very good at detecting authenticity. And if you're authentic with people, that's you are validated in their minds, right? They'll trust your opinion. And so when they actually ask you, what would you do? And you say, I would stop. If this were my loved one, I would say goodbye to them. They actually believe that. They believe what you're saying. Anyway, so, you know, week on, week off, and then I work nights in between there and that. So I do work a lot. I've never really sat down to look how much I work, but on my OR weeks, I work less than on my ICU weeks. So it probably evens out kind of okay on average. If you take all of my work hours and you even them out, it's kind of okay. And I do, you know, the always question is, do you feel like you have work-life balance? And I feel like I do. I feel like I do have pretty good work-life balance. So when I started my career, maybe not right away, but I promised my wife two things. It was, I will never work more than what I'm working right now. I will never work more than what I'm working right now. And that I will not work at home. I will not do any work at home. And I very much follow that philosophy very well. What that entails is, when you're in academic medicine, that sometimes there's this like, oh, you gotta seek academic advancement. You have to write papers. You have to do all this stuff. Nonsense. Okay. Do what you want. Do what you want. This idea, this old school idea that you need to sacrifice your family, it's either family or career, is absolutely absurd. And it is based on like old patriarchal systems, right? I wish I could say they're old, right? Patriarchal systems are still very much in place. Patriarchy in medicine is very, very, still very much in place, okay? And I should probably qualify that a little more. So going on, so there's this, you know, in academic medicine, I'm really talking about academic medicine. I love academic medicine. I'm in academic medicine. And when I finished residency and fellowship, I always thought I would go into private practice. I'm like, I don't want to do any academics. I just want to show up to work and go home. But I realized that would probably be too boring. And, that's a profit driven model, and not, which isn't to say that academic medicine is not profit driven. It absolutely is. Even though they claim they're nonprofits, they still are profit seeking models. They just use their profits in slightly different ways. And I mean slightly different ways. What was my point? I forgot. Hang on. I don't remember. Okay, so yeah, I always thought I was going to do private practice, but I went into academic medicine. I love academic medicine. But you do not need to sacrifice your life for your academic career. My philosophy is my family is the first thing in my life, and then many, many other things come in that hierarchy of importance in my mind, and then my career is like number 5 or number 6 or something like that. Now, providing good patient care and working well with team members is not the same as your career, right? We have this, like, we wrap up our career like it's this thing that you have to do. It's just an outmoded way of thinking. You are not your career. Your value is not your career. Your value is, you know, as a healthcare provider, is being a good clinician. That is your value. And that unfortunately, and what I mean by good clinician is caring for patients, advocating for patients, and providing the best for every patient at all times. That's being a good clinician. That's the value of healthcare. And healthcare systems, right, that's not really what they recognize as value. They value other things, like writing academic papers, for example, is kind of a way of having currency. Now, I enjoy writing academic papers, and I do. Mostly I write papers about cardiac ICU stuff, cardiac, you know, anesthesiology. So I really enjoy I write papers because I enjoy it. What was I saying? So there's this emphasis on like, oh, it's all about, you got to go, you know, go on conferences and learn things like this. I honestly think all of this these are leftovers from a patriarchal system to get men away from their families. Honestly, I don't think I'm too far off saying that. I think this whole system of like, oh, you know, becoming a established and renowned doctor, blah, 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 blah. I really think it's just an outmoded patriarchal system that was an excuse to get men out of their homes, away from their wives. I don't think I'm exaggerating. And I think a lot of that is leftover. So, what I mean by leftover, the emphasis, your career, you got to advance your career. I think it's a patriarchal outmoded system. And the new system should be your family is first. Being at home with your family is more important than anything about your career. Like, I know this stuff sounds obvious, but people need to hear this. People need to hear that. So another thing with that is leadership positions. So another thing I basically have no interest in is being in leadership positions within my academic system. I do not want to do any leadership because it's more work it's more work. And what is the, you're just becoming part of a bureaucratic system that may or may not function all that well, depending on where you're at. And this is not for anybody that's listening that knows where I work, this is not an attack of my institution. I do like my institution, just like any institution has its flaws, but I do like my academics institution. This is not intended to be an attack against my academic institution. This is just generally talking. Taking leadership positions, what's the reward? All it does is take me away from my family more. Attend mostly pointless meetings, right? Arbitrary meetings to come to arbitrary consensus about decisions that really don't need a committee to make decisions about. It's just part of, you know, corporate bureaucracy. That's just, I think it serves other purposes than what it these are for career advancements and placeholders, and be like, hey, I did this. You know, I've been in meetings and committees before, and it's not for me. It's not for me because I feel like when I'm sitting in meetings and stuff, it's mostly pointless, and it's wasting my time. It's taking me away from my daughter. That is how I see meetings. Honestly, that is how I see meetings. I get nothing out of it. I contribute nothing. I learned a bunch of jargon that a committee is using, or I don't learn it. I don't know. I don't see it. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but, I have no interest in doing leadership positions because, I don't think they, I don't think they really help things a whole lot. And they just take me away from my priority, which is my wife and daughter. That is my priority. So I don't do any leadership positions, and I have no interest in doing more leadership positions because all it is just eating away into my life at home and away from my wife and daughter. So I have no interest in that. And I don't plan on doing any major leadership positions. Now, what's my whole point with what I'm talking about today is you are not your career and you're not your job. And there's something deeply pathologic about American culture and Western culture. It's not just American culture, right? All of the bad things about American culture, they're everywhere else, right? I mean, it's been exported everywhere, right? And the bad thing is identifying with your career. You are not your, it doesn't matter what you do. You're not your career. Now you may really enjoy your career and it's part of your identity and there's nothing wrong with that, but should not eclipse who you are. And it's not who you should be. And I've said this before, when I meet people, new people these days, I don't ask what they do for a living. In fact, I don't really, not that I don't care, but it's like, I don't ask them, you know, what's your job? You know, if that happens to come up, it comes up. But because what that does is it's the signifier to people, you know, that's the emphasis of your personhood is what your job is. When I'm working with a new medical student or new resident, I refrain from asking, what do you plan on going into? Like, oh, are you going to go into ENT or are you going to do a fellowship? I don't ask those things. I ask, you know, what do you like to do for fun? Like, tell me about yourself. Who are you as a person? I don't care. Your career is not who you are. Our Westernized culture definitely wants it. Number one, wants us to identify with our career, wants us to internalize that as part of our identity. And then number two, it wants to make us consumers, right? So we have output and we have input. it's kind of depressing to think about. The greatest lie, one of the greatest lies that's ever told politically is that there's a difference between government and corporations. And there's really not. It's all just one enormous bureaucratized mass that colludes with one another, and it's all just one big thing. And the whole aim is just to, you know, is to make us as many people as possible, put in as much input as possible, and then to consume as much as possible to keep the you know, this engine running. And you know, it's very successful. And the whole point is to fracture who we are, to monopolize our attention now with technology and social media and the internet, monopolize our attention, fracture our attention, siphon us off from our families, siphon our attention off from our families, have us spending as much as possible, consuming things that we don't need, having us engage as little as possible with our families and with our communities. That is the reality. The less we are engaged with our communities and our families, the more, you know, the more we're, corporations are able to extract dollars from us. That is the cold, hard reality of it. And I think the more you fight about, hey, my career is not my identity, the more you're fighting that. Now, I didn't realize how I've been talking. I'm 100% in a place of privilege to even be talking about these things. Many, many, many people cannot decide, oh, I'm going to spend time with my family, right? Because you have to, many people just have to work to even survive, to even pay their bills, to bring home food. So I wholly recognize my position of privilege to even be talking about these things and that I have the option, right? That's another thing altogether. Situations are so bad for so many Americans that they don't have this option to even be like, you know, there could be people listening to this being like, wow, this guy is completely out of touch. Maybe, and I probably am. Of course I'm out of touch. I don't live like most Americans live, right? I have a very good career. I'm well compensated. And I get to, and with that comes a lot of freedom that most Americans do not enjoy. And because I've been lucky enough to be in, to have the job that I have. So it's just sad that, you know, what I'm saying, not everybody can relate to, because you have to work and you don't have the option to spend time with your family. And then think of all the fracturing of generations that can follow from that. It's just sad. It's sad. And I also recognize that, having a family and having children is not the ultimate goal of all people, and nor should it be. If you're listening to this and you're like, oh, well, I don't really care about, I don't have children. I'm not married. I don't really relate. Whatever it is, like my whole point is, you know, whatever your career is, it should not, I don't think, in my opinion, it should be your life. But you know, and maybe your personal identity and your career really go hand in hand, right? Maybe you study film, and that's a big part of your life. And then you make films as well. But still, I think my whole point is there are things to prioritize above your own career, whether that's, your own personal development, whether that's working on your, mental health, your well-being, engaging whatever creative spark that gets you going, whether that's simply playing video games or visiting your mother, or, you know, developing a relationship with you, whatever it is, just insert it here. I think you get my point. All right, let's answer some questions. I'm gonna do something a little different today. I get tons of DMs in TikTok and Instagram that I can never get to. I can't answer all of them, of course. I'm gonna open them up and just read some of them without. This will be I'm opening and reading them without having prior read them, and I'm sure a lot of them are absurd. But let's just let's see where this goes. Okay, so I'm opening the. And I'm not going to reveal the identity, anything about the identity of who these people are. And I won't embarrass anybody. Okay, here's one. I'm sure I've seen a video from you or another ICU doc about why the excess death figures don't mean exactly what the average anti-vaxxer. What? I don't know, but of course your average cooker just wants to, I don't even know what this person's talking about. I mean, I know they're talking about the excess death. Yeah, I got nothing to say about that. I'm so sick. I'm so over talking about anti-vax stuff. Here's another one. Hello. I've been following your book recommendations on your pinned video from my local libraries. B.S. Joss has been my favorite so far. Absolutely. Bullshit Joss by David Graeber. Do you have any recommendations for an 11-year-old? He consumes one or two books a day and is currently enjoying the Mabel Jones series by Will Mabbitt. Thanks in advance. For any recommendations for an 11-year-old, I honestly do not read any. I don't read young adult. And I read children's books, but probably too young for an 11-year-old. Bullshit Jobs is an amazing book by David Graeber. If you know anything about me, you know I talk about him constantly. Sorry, I don't really have much to say about that. Okay, here's another one. No, we're not going to read that one. I'm not going to read that one. Sorry, this is a bad idea. Okay, here's another one. A dumb, silly question for you, Doc. Does anesthesia make your hair fall out faster if you are prone to male pattern baldness? Not that I'm aware of. That is not, I've never heard of that. I've never seen that. Anesthesia does not have that effect. I mean, is it possible anesthesia has that effect? Sure. But what is anesthesia? Right. It's many, many different things. And that's not something I've ever seen any data about. Here's another one. I know you don't know me, but I follow you and I'm in medicine. I just saw your tribute. To Von Vitti. Okay. This is a bad idea. Sorry. I'm not doing this. Anyway, the reason that was a bad idea, these messages people are sharing are way too personal. I shouldn't be airing them on this podcast. Anyway, but I will talk about, there was this creator named Von Vitti, V-O-N-V-I-D-D-Y. His name was Joe McClinsky, and he completed suicide just like last week, and he was a TikTok creator. His handle was Von Vitti, and I followed the guy, a young guy, and he was really funny, and he had a great social commentary, and he was a very unique creator, and I posted a video. I was just very committed suicide, and it was just I didn't know the guy, and it was just very sad, obviously. And I think let me just take a little tangent here about suicide. That there's this and people, I know people probably agree with me, will agree with what I'm gonna say, which I don't agree with, that are listening to this, but there's this like
thought that, oh, people have the right to commit suicide. I realize I'm using the wrong term, committing suicide. It's just what I'm going to go with at the moment. I know it's not a good term to use because it's like a crime, commit. Anyway, there's this right, there's people that talk about people have the right to life and the right to commit suicide. I think it's kind of a moot, not a moot, it's irrelevant to talking about the right to suicide. People, of course, people have the natural right to commit suicide. And people can kill themselves. That's not, yeah, it was like talking about the legality and the, like, people have the right, they have the natural right to kill themselves. That's not, I think it's like this abstraction that distracts us from actually helping people with mental health problems. And there's this thought that you should allow people to commit suicide, just allow them. Suffering, life is suffering, allow, they should be allowed, they have that right, don't get in the way of that, blah, blah, blah. I completely reject that, okay? I refuse to believe that. And one of the reasons I refuse to believe that, and I reject this sympathy towards, hey, let people, you know, live their lives or not live their lives, however they see fit, is my answer to that is suffering is not an inevitability. People that commit suicide, in that moment, they're in an awful, awful spot, or the attempt suicide of their lives. And they take that one spot and they expand it out and they think that they believe this is part of the mental illness. They believe that's what their life is, that their life is suffering. Their suffering is not an inevitability. It doesn't mean that person is going to suffer for the rest of their lives. If you can help people and get them through those moments where they desire suicide and get them through that, their suffering can get, it's possible for it to get into the rearview mirror and they can move on and they can move past this. That is why I do not agree with this. I am fundamentally opposed to the thought that you should just let people kill themselves and not help them. I think it's ridiculous, honestly. I get a little upset talking about it. I see these comments all the time whenever I talk about suicide, like, oh, you know, just let people kill themselves. No. No. Okay. No. All right, moving on. Let's talk about a book. I've read so many amazing books since last time I did this podcast. I don't even know where to begin. But here's the nonfiction book I'm going to talk about. It's called Why Liberalism Failed by Patrick Deneen, D-E-N-E-E-N. So it's really important, talking about this book, it's really important to clarify the use of the word liberalism for this book. This book offers a scathing criticism of liberalism defined as a departure from monarchy and feudalism and into the age of like free market capitalism, the right to property, equality before the law, civil liberties, and individualism. All of that together is what liberalism, classic liberalism is. And that's what I'm talking about, and that's what the author is talking about, okay? So it's not, liberalism in this book is not used as a criticism against modern day, quote, liberals, but it encompasses the entire political American spectrum, where the left and the right are merely a progressive and neoliberal branch of the same system. And it's this classical definition of liberalism that the author attacks. The author catastrophizes it, makes one long straw man argument about over the length of the entire book. This book has some good points, has some weird stuff, and it has some downright nonsense that I'm going to just talk to you about. But I overall found this book worthwhile to read, and it got me thinking, which is good. So here's a quote from the book. Liberalism failed because liberalism succeeded. The author says stuff like this constantly, thinking that these statements themselves serve as evidence, and that's kind of the issue with this book. This book is mostly just like a bloviating manifesto from a cranky and disenchanted academic that loves to use the word deracinate a whole lot for some reason, which I had to look up that word, by the way. I was like, he used the word deracinate so many times, I had to look it up, which means to deroot. To get the roots, out of an argument or something like that. Anyway, the main argument of this book is that liberalism has bred its own demise by creating a state of isolated individuals who toil and consume and are completely disenfranchised from their communities and government, which is kind of what I was talking about earlier in this podcast, right? So I think this overall conclusion is in many ways very accurate, and it's pertinent. And at the same time, it's also overreaching. My main issue is that the author takes everything to the worst possible strawman conclusions with lots of speculation and then makes sweeping claims. The good of this book is the argument that liberalism is hung by its own petard, right? Both American political parties are two sides of the same liberal coin, advancing both statism and individualism, destroying culture and community, and creating an anti-culture of consumerism. Because of this corrosion, people turn to one of two options. The state, via social democracy, or towards the individual, via free market libertarianism. It's also ultimately a smokescreen, as both parties advance statism, war, globalized hegemonic economic control, with an increasing state and private surveillance state, right? Both political parties do these same things.
I think most of this is true to varying degrees, but the author directly states that liberalism has failed on all levels and is on the verge of collapse without really providing a whole lot of evidence. This entire book is rhetorical conjecture. And according to the author, all colleges are just anarchist, liberal art, rape culture, and all communities are destroyed and under constant state surveillance, right? He's catastrophizes. None of these things are really generalizable, and they kind of make poor anecdotes on which to base an entire book. I like how he talks about the idea of constitutional republic was itself a new form of technology. And the constitutional republic of the United States is the operating system for later technology to be created, which spawned the more consumer-driven, globalized, and individualistic silos that we now find ourselves. The liberal republic itself was the precursor for the future technology in which we are now ensnared. And in this way, liberalism hung itself in its sense, and I do agree with that. The author offers a near nonsensical polemic against modern liberal arts about how it betrayed the founding fathers' intent of like a virtue or religious-based search for knowledge, which is honestly, it was nonsense. He then goes on a tirade against postmodernism and wraps up suggesting that somehow the 2008 financial crisis can be blamed on the current failing liberal arts programs in the United States. It's ridiculous. It's all a bunch of nonsense. It's terribly argued. If I had a dime for every academic I read who blames the fall of modern society on postmodernism, I'd be very wealthy, because people love to blame the destruction of society and postmodernism. It's ridiculous. I'm really sick of that argument. It just doesn't bear a lot of water. Anyway, the main problem with this book is the author places everything bad about Western culture under the umbrella of, quote, liberalism, and has the audacity and smugness to predict that it will all come crumbling down, like it's inevitable. Even worse is that arguing along these lines actually opens people up to considering more autocratic and authoritarian options, something we clearly struggle with right now in 2023. Like, fascism is on the rise. Like, so it's books like this that kind of give people the excuse to be like, hey, maybe we need a strongman to bring everything under control. And the way this book is a bit reckless and a little irresponsible, I thought. The problem is that the world's problems are much more complex than just blaming a single cultural and economic system, right? The apparent and dubious decline of the United States and, quote, liberalism is very clearly multifactorial and deserves a much more nuanced discussion rather than the blunt polemic that the author gives here. Policy, in my opinion, does matter. And changing monetary, fiscal, and social policy can have a lasting impact on real people right at this moment. I remain totally unconvinced that it's impossible to use the current tools of liberalism to make a difference. I do, however, highly endorse the author's ultimate prescription for our ills, which is local community engagement, although this certainly doesn't replace liberalism, so I feel the author offers no real solutions for us. At any rate, I'm conflicted about this book. I'm happy I read it. I thought it was thought-provoking, and I actually recommend that you read it. It's called Why Liberalism Failed by Patrick Deneen, D-E-N-E-E-N. All right, and then let's just talk about a fiction. I've read a bunch of great fiction since the last of this podcast. I'm going to just talk about A Day of Fallen Night by Samantha Shannon. This book was a masterpiece. It's one of the best fantasy books I've ever read, period. Why? The short answer is the beauty and the complexity of the characters with themselves and with one another and with the lore and the cultures that bind them all together. This book meets at the crossroads of really rich characterization and deep world building, which both influence one another. I read this book's technical sequel, which was first in publication. It's called The Priory of the Orange Tree, which is also a phenomenal book. But I thought this was even better. And you can read this book before you read The Priory of the Orange Tree. So the characters are incredible. Each character lives within a unique culture with a very well fleshed out background, which is a lot of what the beginning of the book accomplishes. Each character is driven by their own unique personalities, but also within the values and honor of their respective cultures. They each have extremely interesting histories and motivations. There's Gloraine, soon to be queen of a monarchical kingdom. There's a character called Wolf, who's a soldier with a joint kingdom with this mysterious origin story. There's another character called Dumai. She's from a distant mountain kingdom, also with this mysterious and royal circumstances of her birth. And then there's the character Tanuva, the most interesting character. She's like a 50-year-old warrior. She's a mother. She has a huge heart. Just right off the bat, these characters are really interesting and they're likable. But Shannon thrusts these characters into new circumstances, and then we see them like grow. It's amazing. And if you read a lot of fantasy, the grimdark and morally dubious characters are very popular. But the absolute integrity of these characters is just breathtaking. They're very, very integritous characters.
So I really adored and loved each of these characters. A subtle theme in this book is that you make the best of the culture that's given to you. Yes, you may start to see the cracks around the lore that binds your family and nation, but that doesn't mean you can't be good within those frailties. Lore, as flawed as it is, doesn't have to betray. It can actually bolster the good that is already within people. And that is one of the biggest takeaways from this book. Everywhere within these pages is the expectations that women are a resource for birthing. The weight and the bonds that the main women characters bear in this book because of their uteruses is really showcased, and it's done exceptionally well. Don't get me wrong, this isn't like a moral hand-wringing and finger-shaking at the reader. It's just that a lot of the characters in this book are women, and it deals a lot with all the complexities that come from their expectations to have children, and it's really, really well done. The only weakness of this book was the resolution. It's a bit anticlimactic, and also a tad deus ex machina, you know, where things just kind of work out. But I didn't care. This isn't a book about necessarily about how heroes vanquish enemies. Rather, this is a book about good people choosing to lead with integrity. And I absolutely loved it. It's called A Day of Fallen Night by Samantha Shannon. It's a big one. It's about 800 pages, but I ate it up. Absolutely loved it. Anyway, that's it for me. I'll try to get more episodes up. I know I've been a slacker. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Just bug me on TikTok and Instagram if I don't have one up in a couple weeks. All right, bye.